From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we've worked up a whole show on work.
Hay 2,000, 3,000 gentes atrás de ti que quieren el trabajo.
There's 2,000 or 3,000 people behind you that want your job.
5 or 6 gentes.
Overworked and underpaid, so why not quit? Our investigation into the conditions and lives of Mexican guest workers in all American state fairs and how they're standing up for themselves. Also, a domestic worker's Bill of Rights in California.
When we were there and heard the news that he was going to sign the bill, I said, this can't be true. It's not true. September 26th. I'll never forget it.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this week we're talking about labor. Think of the town fair. Cotton candy, fried food, Ferris wheels. You think it's all American wholesome fun, right?
I want them to see that behind the scenes.
That's Gregory Schell. He's a labor lawyer.
The people operating the rides, setting up and taking down the rides, selling the cotton candy, are often paid far below the minimum wage. They work long hours and live in tough living conditions and essentially are here under terms most of us would not find acceptable.
The truth is that carnivals rely on Mexican and Central American workers, legal guest workers doing seasonal labor. This week, we bring you a special report about these workers, a joint project with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. We start our story at the fair in the tiny town of Bethlehem, Connecticut. There's a worker here operating a flying swing ride. He's short, in his 20s. His name is Vicente. When I speak to him in Spanish, his eyes light up.
Okay, so how many hours a day? What time do you start work?
¿A qué horas empiezas? Today, ahora empecé a las 10.
Today you started at 10 o'clock, it's Saturday. And you'll work until what time? ¿Hasta qué horas vas a trabajar?
Vicente works from 10 in the morning till 10 at night. He says in a good season, he earns about $6,000 over 4.5 months. That sounds like a lot of money, but it works out to an hourly wage of $4.75, not even close to the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. And there's no overtime pay. Still, Vicente says he's pretty satisfied.
The company's good. The boss treats me well.
Seasonal immigrant workers like Vicente come into the country on temporary work permits called H-2B visas. The rules that govern them, though, are very different from the rules for most U.S. workers. Guest workers sign a contract with a company laying out wages and hours when they start a job. But if the company doesn't abide by that contract, the workers have little recourse. That's the focus of a lawsuit currently in federal court in Florida. The case is against a family-owned carnival company called Degler Attractions. The suit exposes how some industries, like seasonal carnivals, are legally exempted from fundamental aspects of federal labor law.
Well, if you look at our minimum wage and overtime laws, they're riddled with exceptions written in.
Gregory Schell represents the 78 plaintiffs in the case, all carnival workers.
Small farms can pay 10 cents an hour. That's legal. Bowling alley employees aren't covered. Taxi cab drivers aren't covered.
And neither are seasonal carnival workers if the company operates fewer than 7 months a year. The plaintiffs argue that Degler should not be exempt from wage and hour laws. They're asking for back pay and overtime. But Degler's lawyer, Wayne Pierce, says the company operates well within the law and the provisions in the H-2B visa program. He points out that H-2B says nothing about overtime or minimum wage.
If the relationship goes for its full length and you are exempt from the Fair Labor Standards Act, which we are, then the H-2B language does not apply to those employers either.
But that lack of oversight can lead to a lack of protection. Gregory Schell says foreign workers here on H-2B visas are often reluctant to complain.
One worker told me, testified in a case, I know you're cheating me. And the foreman said, you know, you're right, I am. But I have a magic pen. And every year at the end of the season, it writes down the names of the workers coming back. And when I get to the name of a complainer, the pen runs out of ink. And I thought very poetically he expressed precisely what the situation is. The workers understand this, and given the options back home, they are loath to complain. The workers you hear from are extraordinarily brave because they have chosen to speak out when dozens and scores of their fellows in their same town have decided to remain silent.
Carnival workers may seem like a small part of the immigrant labor force, but every current immigration reform proposal includes an expansion of the H-2B guest worker program, and that could expose more workers to potential labor abuses. You might wonder why immigrant workers take jobs with such poor working conditions, sometimes returning year after year. The answer lies to the south. The immigrant workers who brought the lawsuit against Degler and the worker I spoke with at the fair in Connecticut all come from an isolated town in Veracruz, Mexico, called Tlapacoyan. People say there's no work here. Even college graduates have a hard time. And if you do get a job, the average pay is $15 to $20 a day.
No hay trabajo.
That's resident Enrique Vasquez. He says the only promise of steady work is with the carnivals in the U.S. He worked for Degler Attractions for 7 seasons.
No te dejan opciones.
There's no other option. No hay, you understand?
¿Me entiendes?
Vasquez says Degler paid him as if he worked 40 hours a week, when in fact, it was often almost double that. For starters, he says, he worked 12-hour shifts on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday alone.
A las 11 de la noche termina el show.
After the show ends at 11, we're disassembling until 10, 11 the next day. In those 3 days, you've already worked 40, 50 hours.
Ya juntaste sus 40, 50 horas.
What's more, Vasquez and the other workers say they were charged for certain expenses unfairly. $350 for recruitment and visa fees, and $60 a week to live in trailers with no plumbing, hot water, kitchen, heat, or air conditioning.
Pues con donde vivía yo con muchas cucarachas. Las chiquitas.
He says his trailer had cockroaches.
El piso podrido.
And the floor was rotted through.
Si te ponen condiciones, ¿qué haces? No te puedes mover.
And there was nothing he could do about it. Vasquez is one of the plaintiffs in the case against Degler. The lead plaintiff, Isaú Morales, has a worse story. Morales had an accident when he was assembling a ride.
We were laying down these tensors, cables that go underground. When the last one didn't close, it snapped back and hit me in the face.
The cable broke his jaw. The company took him to the ER, but he had to go back to work the next day.
I couldn't move my face much because it was full of blood clots. I had to ice my face because the doctor said I needed to get the swelling down. I was taking tickets, and when there were fewer people, I'd ice my face.
As punishing as these jobs are, many people in Tlapacoyan want them. And access to them is controlled by two brothers, one of whom, Víctor Apolinar, was just elected mayor. It's a profitable business to be a recruiter. Workers say they charge $350 a head as a recruitment fee. Some, but not all of that, covers the cost of the H-2B visa and transportation to the consulate to pick it up. Apparently, Víctor Apolinar, though, doesn't like to talk about his business. We made several attempts to meet him, all unsuccessful. The lawsuit against Degler is about more than just one company or one town. To Gregory Schell, it's about the future of low-wage immigrant workers in the U.S.
This is the program, this H-2B program, that the employer community would like to be the model for guest worker programs going forward after immigration reform. The employer community wants these workers of this sort under this program to be available throughout our low-wage economy.
Meanwhile, Degler's lawyer Wayne Pierce says the company has always acted well within the law.
The Deglers run a very good, a very well-respected small family business, and they have done so for decades. You only are able to reach that point in your life if you treat your employees appropriately. That includes paying them a good wage. That includes making sure that they have good housing and good working conditions. We know those things. That's why we try to meet them more than halfway.
And the proof, he says, is that many of Degler's employees, including several in the lawsuit, keep coming back.
Because it works for us, too. If it's not working for them, it's not working for us.
Back in Tlapacoyan, Enrique Vasquez says he had to speak up.
I realized I have rights. If you let people step all over you, you'll always be on the bottom, because that's where they want you.
Until opportunities expand, people like Vasquez will continue to be caught in a no-win situation, and many will keep going to work at the carnivals.
There's 2,000 or 3,000 people behind you that want your job.
One of those waiting is 18-year-old Luis Antonio Martinez, who works as a hotel clerk in Tlapacoyan. He's planning to go work with the carnivals next year, even though he knows the hardships. Lots of travel, little sleep, little time even to eat.
No matter what, here you can't get ahead. You do what you can, not what you want. You have to risk it. Work. You have no choice, even if the work is hard.
The job Martinez has in his town pays him $120 a week. The $350 a week he can make at the carnival can get him closer to what he really wants.
Primera, hacerme una casa. Segunda, terminar mi carrera de ingeniería civil que dejé a medias, seguir estudiando.
To build a house and finish his degree in civil engineering. The lawsuit against Degler Attractions is set to go to trial in January of 2014, and we'll keep you informed with updates about this story. Our story about the carnival workers was reported in collaboration with John Carlos Frey of the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Coming up on Latino USA, why organized labor is backing immigration reform.
When we help immigrant workers get rights on the job, we help every worker.
AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka on Latino USA. No se vayan. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. There are many reasons why immigration from Mexico to the United States has come to a virtual standstill. A slow U.S. economy, an increase in border security, and the passage of show-me-your-papers laws in many states. But another reason that might not be so obvious is that Mexico's economy is booming right now. Last year, it grew by 4%. That's four times the rate of Brazil's economy. A lot of the growth is due to high-tech manufacturing. From Mexico, Marlon Bishop has our story.
When he graduates next year, Jaciel Olea won't be going to the United States to look for a job. He says even 5 years ago, he would have thought about it.
Before, yes, it was perhaps wiser to go to the United States or to Europe. But right now, you have a good chance to get a nice job here, well paid.
Olea is a student in the Aerospace Engineering Program at the National Polytechnic Institute in Mexico City. Here in the school's thermodynamics lab, he pokes around a model plane engine, taking measurements. One day soon, Olea hopes to be overseeing the construction of real engines for Bombardier or Cessna. They're just two of the 270 aviation companies operating in Mexico.
And it grows every day. Perhaps in 5-10 years, we'll be designing parts of airplanes here in Mexico.
More and more, the Mexican worker looks like Olea, well-educated and working in one of the high-tech industries driving Mexico's recent manufacturing boom. Auto, aerospace, and technology companies have been investing big time in Mexico, gradually replacing the country's traditional lower-paying industries such as textiles and shoes. The average Mexican factory is looking less like a sweatshop and more like this. Volkswagen's plant in the city of Puebla is the biggest car factory in North America, employing 18,000 people. Inside, it feels like a small city. Dona Hivayas is the plant's official tour guide.
This next hall, we have 215 robots.
Robots. Their serpent-like arms belch sparks, sculpting metal hunks into car parts as Mexican engineers supervise. Every 90 seconds, a new vehicle rolls off the assembly line. Late last year, Volkswagen subsidiary Audi announced plans to build a new $1.4 billion plant, also in Puebla. Volkswagen Vice President Thomas Carrick says that companies like Audi are coming to Mexico in part because of its prime location, smack in the middle of the Americas, with ports on two oceans.
The fact that from Mexico you can export to many countries of the world, not only to North America, but also to South America and to Europe, to Japan, with preferential conditions in terms of duties.
In terms of duties, there aren't any. In 1994, Mexico implemented NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and went on to sign similar treaties with just about everybody, 44 countries in all. That comes in handy when you're selling big, expensive things, like cars. Mexico has both the technical expertise to run production and a relatively low cost of labor. All of this is helping Mexico compete successfully with the manufacturing sector of China, its main economic rival.
Tengo un buen futuro, me he ido bastante bien.
Hector Delgado, a worker on Volkswagen's assembly line, says he makes the equivalent of $30 a day. That's not much by U.S. standards. An average U.S. auto worker makes about $30 an hour. In Mexico, though, Delgado's salary is six times the minimum wage and puts him solidly in the middle class. It's allowed him to put his kids through college. Both of his sons are engineers.
For me, the idea was for them to push themselves, to advance, to get educated. Every day, there are more and more people with educations, so we have to move forward ourselves, too.
The higher wages paid in high-tech industries have provided families like the Delgados with real social mobility. Catherine Donato, a sociologist at Vanderbilt University, thinks these demographic changes will affect the rate of migration to the U.S. in the long term, even if immigration reform passes.
Now there really are many more jobs in the Mexican economy than we could have imagined 30 years ago. And I don't think that the outflow from Mexico to the U.S. will be numerically what it was in the 1990s.
But even as the middle class has grown, so has extreme poverty. While a quarter of Mexicans are now part of the middle class, more than half live below the poverty line, according to the World Bank.
there's a larger gap between the people who have something and the people who don't. And so here's the situation. The poorest of the poor don't migrate. They're the ones who have the fewest resources to do so.
The wealth disparity isn't the only drag on the economy. Despite signing all those free trade agreements, Mexico still relies overwhelmingly on the U.S. to buy its products, leaving it vulnerable to the economic winds north of the border. Victor Piz, editor of the economic newspaper El Financiero, says the country's growth may be hard to sustain.
Clearly, the economic panorama for the U.S. continues to be uncertain, and this uncertainty indicates a lower growth for Mexico's economy in the year to come.
Even so, there's more opportunity in Mexico than there was in the early 90s, when immigration was at its peak. The question remains whether the country can provide that opportunity to more of its people. For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop.
As the U.S. economy lags and Mexico's grows, American employers are still pushing for Mexican labor, and that means dealing with immigration reform. Interviewer Al Hunt put it this way when he spoke recently to House Judiciary Chairman Bob Goodlatte.
Let's look at this from 30,000 feet for a minute. Now, the AFL-CIO is for the Senate bill. The Chamber of Commerce is for the Senate bill. Silicon Valley is for the Senate bill. McDonald's is for the Senate bill. The impression that's given is that you're letting the Steve Kings, the nativist, even the racist, influence the decisions of people like you and John Boehner.
Not at all. We believe that there is a right way to do this that doesn't change the fact that we need to address all three of these areas, and we should do it, but we should do it responsibly, and we should do it right. And it's more important to get it done right than by any specific timetable.
Time is indeed running short in this congressional session, but the corporate, immigrant, and faith communities say they're tired of waiting. In fact, some activists and clergy have been fasting to push congressional action for immigration reform. Cristian Avila lives in Phoenix, Arizona. His parents brought him to the U.S. when he was just 9 years old.
The reason I'm fasting is I can no longer ignore the pain it comes with being an immigrant, and I have to stand up and do something about it. And this fast is a recommitment for me, for myself, for my community, for my family, for this country, to do the right thing, to do the moral choice, and to have immigration reform pass this year.
With a tough job market, some Americans might feel that they can't afford reforms that would welcome foreign labor. But American organized labor is embracing immigration reform. And the AFL-CIO's president, Richard Trumka, joined me to explain why.
Welcome, President Trumka.
Thanks for having me on.
You've heard the criticism before of your leadership, perhaps too militant, perhaps too aggressive, perhaps too threatening of the status quo. And now the AFL-CIO is saying to its membership, look, we not only care about immigration, but as part of one of our resolutions, we are also telling, your fellow worker, not just join the brotherhood of unions, but then we're going to help you become citizens. And I wonder about that critique where it's just like, you know what, Mr. Trumka, we understand the numbers, but this is going to be a difficult sell for a more traditional AFL-CIO.
Our members, our unions are all in lockstep right now. Our top priority right now is getting citizenship for 11.5 million workers, for every worker in this country who contributes and is a citizen in every way except on paper. We are all there. We know this. Here's another important thing, Maria. When we help immigrant workers get rights on the job, we help every worker get a right on the job. Because if they can discriminate and deny wages and misclassify immigrant workers, then every worker in this country suffers.
So there's been a tremendous frustration within the AFL-CIO on how slow comprehensive immigration reform has been going, the fact that it may not end up being passed? Are you still hopeful for something in 2013, or are you thinking 2014 or more like 2017?
No, it's going to get passed in 2013. We've been running an unprecedented national campaign to support immigration reform with citizenship. Our members have made over 100,000 calls to Congress. We have 246 resolutions that have been passed by our state and our local feds representing over 9 million people. We've held 542 labor immigration events since this summer. Our fight for the citizenship for 11 million people, it's the crisis that we need to resolve right now. That's our top priority.
And part of that movement in terms of the AFL-CIO is to support guest workers. Can you make it clear where you stand on the position of guest workers as part of comprehensive immigration reform?
We believe that anybody who comes into this country, guest workers, ought to have the same rights as the workers who are here. Because look, here's what happened under the old guest worker program. They would bring a worker into the country. The employer held the visa, and the employer had the right to petition for citizenship. So anytime that worker said, "You've misclassified me, I'm getting less than I'm entitled to, or these conditions are unsafe," they just showed them the road. So we insisted on several things. We insisted that when a worker comes in, the worker gets the visa. Two, we insisted that the worker get the right to petition for citizenship. And we insisted that any workers brought in be paid at least market rate or the prevailing wage that's in that area. It's not fair to bring a worker in and have them do the same job as me, for instance, and pay them 50% of what I earn. And that's what we were successful in negotiating and implementing into the Senate program on this issue.
So our investigative report looking into county, state, carnival fairs, what we found is that the guest workers that work at these fairs are exempt from minimum wage and overtime laws. They often have to pay the recruitment fees in order to get hired. They suffer all kinds of abuses. So are you saying that that kind of guest worker program is not the guest worker program of the future for the United States?
It's absolutely not the guest worker program of the future. We wouldn't tolerate that. No one should tolerate that. As a country, we are better than that. I don't care where they're born. I don't care what they're doing. They ought to have the same rights, and they ought to be treated with dignity and respect.
Can you tell me a little bit more about this relationship of developing a commission between the AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Commerce to look precisely at guest workers? Tell me a little bit more about what's the status of this and how you resolve the tension behind a Chamber of Commerce that is saying, you know, American workers first versus the AFL-CIO that is saying, yes, but we need to look at the immigrant workers and at immigrants who are undocumented. What about that tension between the Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO on this?
Well, the tension is they want to bring in as many workers as they can bring in at any wage and without any rights. And we said that's not going to happen. So the commission will do this. The commission, if an employer comes in and says there's a shortage of workers in this country for any job, let's just say engineers. In the past, there was no way to determine whether there was a shortage. And there was no way to decide the wages that they brought in. They would pay them half the wages or a quarter of the wages of workers that were here. The result of that was it drove wages down for everybody. Immigrant workers, documented, undocumented, union members, non-union members, everybody's wages got driven down. So this commission would do this. If they say there's a shortage, this commission will decide if there is or if there isn't. If there is a shortage, then the numbers can be adjusted to allow more people to come in to meet that shortage. But it also triggers another item. It also triggers training for those workers that are here, so that the shortage can ultimately be filled by those workers that are here as well.
Where does this stand in terms of the Republican resistance precisely to this commission?
Well, we got that passed through the Senate with a very large vote. It was 80-some votes in the Senate side. Now, we're still battling with the House Republicans, because the House Republicans, they'll use anything as an excuse not to act. You know, we're going to continue to push them, continue with this campaign. And I think that it's inevitable that this is going to become law, not just because it's right, but because the politics are now on our side. The vast majority of Americans say the system is broken, it doesn't work, it abuses workers, it must be changed.
President Trumka, there will be people who say, you know what, this is a very self-interested union that wants to make sure that Latino immigrants become citizens so that they can get out the vote, because this is an important voting bloc, and that this is, about protecting workers' rights. But it really is also about assuring your political power in a very shifting United States. Your response is what?
Isn't that democracy? Isn't that American? That's the difference between us and them. The Republicans right now try to reduce the number of people who are eligible to vote. We believe that you should increase the number so that everybody has a voice in a country that affects their lives and their children's lives every single day. And by the way, I do not apologize in the least for wanting to get 11 million and a half workers citizenship. I take that mantle proudly, because somebody was there to help my family get citizenship. I owe it to the next generation to get them citizenship as well.
So there's talk about economic recovery. What do you know, President Trumka, in terms of Latino workers and how they're faring in what's being called the economic recovery?
Well, you know, look, the Great Recession affected all workers. It especially hurt Latinos and the minority populations, and the gains of the very weak economic recovery, they've not especially benefited the Latino community. Latinos have been disproportionately affected by America's growing income inequality, and many Latinos continue to be unemployed or underemployed. Right now, the unemployment rate for Latinos was 9.8%, and additionally, about one out of five Latino workers were underemployed, unable to find full-time jobs. They are there. And then let me just add this, Maria. Look, it doesn't just hurt the Latino workers that are here. Immigrant workers support their families back home. In the last couple of years, $61 billion have been sent to the Caribbean and to Latin America from workers in this country. That's not happening at the same rate. Those families back home are also hurting. And so the recovery, to the extent there has been one, has bypassed most American workers, but it has especially bypassed Latinos and people of color.
President Richard Trumka of the AFL-CIO, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thanks for having me on. I hope you have me back on again. I really appreciate it.
Coming up on our show about work.
When a worker is undocumented, they're particularly vulnerable to wage theft. They're more vulnerable to sexual harassment and assault and exploitation more broadly.
The obstacles faced by those who clean our houses and care for our children. Domestic workers on Latino USA, no se vayan.
Oh,
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. After a seven-year fight, California became the third state in the country to enact a domestic workers' bill of rights after New York and Hawaii. The law applies to housekeepers, nannies, and caregivers who are excluded from the protections of the National Labor Relations Act. California has the largest number of domestic workers of any state, about 200,000, mostly immigrant women. The law will give them the right to overtime pay after 9 hours, but the workers didn't get everything they hoped for, things like meal breaks, sick days, and workers' comp, though they're still celebrating its passage. Emily Wilson met two domestic workers at the Women's Collective, a group for immigrant women in San Francisco.
My name is Guillermina Castellanos, and I'm an organizer with La Colectiva here in San Francisco. I organize domestic workers who take care of children and older people and housekeepers.
My name is Inés Lazarte. I work with older people. That's my specialty. I have a lot of years working with older people.
I was a domestic worker starting at 5 years old in my country. When I came to the United States in 1985, I took care of children in Los Angeles, in Santa Ana, California, to be more precise. I was 15 and I was abused. They didn't want to pay me, and also the man in the house tried to molest me.
I've also worked the night shift from 10 or 9 at night to 7 or 8 in the morning. I work more than 12 hours, but the pay is the same, unfortunately. The night shift is much more exhausting because you can't sleep, and there's nowhere for you to sleep or anything. This Bill of Rights is going to change my life and the lives of others as well, because now the employers have to pay more after 9 hours, the way they should and always should have. Before they turned a blind eye, but now they can't do that.
When we were there and heard the news that he was going to sign the bill, that the governor was going to sign the Bill of Rights, my body shook. I said, oh my God, this can't be true. It's not true. That date, September 26th, I'll never forget it. No lo voy a olvidar. Donde el gobernador se sentó y firmó la Carta de Derechos. Eso para mí.
When the governor sat and signed the bill, that was something big for me, something historic, a legacy that I can leave for my grandchildren, and a legacy that all women involved in the campaign can have in their hearts and minds and continue to fight.
Y continuar la lucha. When he signed it, she sent us a message, and I jumped for joy. At work, they looked at me and said, what's with you? Are you crazy? No, it's that we won a victory. It's been so thrilling. It's really been so thrilling.
So we just heard from domestic workers in California, but now we want to turn to the rest of the country, where 65% of domestic workers are immigrants or people of color, and most of them are not organized. Andrea Cristina Mercado is with the National Domestic Worker Alliance. Welcome to Latino USA, Andrea.
Thank you for having me.
So there are protections in California now. What about domestic workers in other parts of the country and the question of what is available to them?
The laws vary greatly, and I think it's important to really root it in the history of domestic work in this country. In the 1930s, at the height of the U.S. labor movement, domestic workers and farm workers were excluded from some really basic labor protections in the Fair Labor Standards Act. It was basically a concession to Southern segregationists who were afraid of African-American organizing, and many of those exclusions are still in place today. So I think we see kind of a patchwork of laws, and you have a really wide range of employment practices. There are the fabulous employers who offer vacation pay and Christmas bonuses. And then we see experiences like the one that Guillermina was talking about, where it's sexual assault and wage theft and modern-day slavery in some instances. And so we've been Going state by state, in New York, we passed a domestic worker bill, and in Hawaii, and now recently in California. Next year, we're looking at Massachusetts and Illinois and Colorado and Connecticut and Oregon and more. So it's really catching fire in a lot of ways.
Is it because of this history that you say harkens back to racism in the South and the organizing of African-American domestic workers? Is that the essential reason of why domestic workers are excluded from worker protections, or is it something else as well?
What's so interesting about domestic work is that it's really at the intersection of race and class and gender. So yes, we have a very specific history of discrimination based on race and because of the role that slaves played doing domestic work. And at the same time, I think we can also talk about the way that the work that traditionally women have done in the home that hasn't been paid and has often been undervalued, there's obviously a deep connection there between that and then the women of color who are doing that work for pay as a career. I think it's fair to say the fact that that work of taking care of children and our homes and our elders isn't really valued by society. By extension, the women of color who are doing that work for pay are often disrespected and underpaid and undervalued.
So you wanted to base your work on data. So you did a survey of domestic workers, which I find fascinating because it's a difficult thing in terms of actually pulling them all together. What did the results tell us about who these workers are?
We knew that there was a need for change and a need for policy. And as we were going to policymakers, they were saying, show me the data. And there just was no data. So we realized that we actually had to create the data. And we trained hundreds of women across the country, like Guillermina and Ines, in many different languages to go out in their communities and do surveys at bus stops and on buses and in laundromats and in parks and of their neighbors and friends. And I think that the survey results were in line with the stories and the experiences we were hearing all the time, but to actually see the data of how many domestic workers are single mothers and aren't making enough to put food on their table. It tells of work that is so important, and yet the women who are taking care of our families, but we're really not taking care of theirs.
In particular, in your survey, what did you come up with in terms of particular issues that undocumented domestic workers face?
When a worker is undocumented, they're particularly vulnerable to wage theft. They're more vulnerable to sexual harassment and assault and exploitation more broadly. So I think we found that many times these workers are being paid less than the minimum wage, and they are struggling to feed their families and pay their rent. We see really high incidence of verbal abuse. I think that the data results are really striking.
So your survey turned up these results. 91% of domestic workers who are abused did not complain because they fear losing their job. And 85% of undocumented immigrants who experienced abuse did not complain because they feared that their immigration status could be used against them if they did complain.
Yeah. Yeah, and we hear those stories all the time. Women come into our offices talking about how they were forced to sleep on the basement floor, working around the clock. Oftentimes, they may talk about the love that they feel for the children they care for, or the elder they care for, or just the fear that the employer threatens them and they're afraid to talk to anyone about what's happening.
There are a lot of people who would say, you know what, you are starting with the odds against you. The population that you're trying to organize is at a disadvantage itself simply because they are so hard to amass. They're working class women. They don't have information about their rights. They're afraid to file complaints. So what's the bright spot?
That's something that we've been told over and over again. In New York, as we were fighting for a domestic worker bill, in California, you know, everyone just says it's just not possible. It's not feasible. It's not realistic. And yet we mobilize hundreds and thousands of women and get them involved and take them to the Capitol to speak their truth and tell their stories. And we're winning. I think that that's really speaks to the power of organizing low-income women, women of color. And one of the things that I love about our movement and many other people are struck by is that really we're organizing from a place of love, and that we know that transformation is possible, and that when we all come together and share our stories and a commitment to fight for change for the future generations, we're unstoppable.
Andrea, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you for having me.
And now, from the people you trust with your homes and your children, to the people you trust for your information. We here at Latino USA hope that we have your trust, and we strive to earn it every day. But when it comes to breaking news and other topics, where do you go? For this week's News or Noise, our regular segment on news literacy, producer Daisy Rosario went back in time to talk to students about trust, who has it, and why it's important.
Good evening. President Nixon reportedly will announce his resignation tonight, and Vice President Ford will become the nation's 38th president tomorrow.
There once was a newsman so trusted that people called him Uncle Walter.
In the swiftly moving events of this busy day in Washington,
Watergate, Vietnam, the assassinations of both JFK and Martin Luther King Jr. For many, he was the voice of these events. His name was Walter Cronkite, and he was considered the most trusted man in America. And before Cronkite, there was Edward R. Murrow.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid siren.
He made a name for himself in radio during World War II, providing detailed and descriptive accounts of the London Blitz.
A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance.
There was no internet.
One single beam.
There was no television.
Above me now. People are walking along quite quietly. We're just at the entrance of an air raid shelter here, and I must.
At the time, it was a huge deal that these reports were even live. But that's the past. Now, with all the technology and options, it's gotten much harder to figure out where to turn for trusted information. Recently, I visited my old school, the aptly named Edward R. Murrow High School in Brooklyn, to talk to students who work on the school paper about trust.
How does it feel to be back? It's awesome.
We talked about Cronkite and Murrow, even Tom Brokaw, and I asked if any of them watched the news on television. Most didn't. But some did recognize one current anchor man.
Hello, I'm Brian Williams of NBC Nightly News and host of NBC's Rock Center, and I, too, would like to slow jam this news.
Hit me three times!
Some students had seen NBC's Brian Williams on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon.
Less than a month after signing a fiscal cliff deal and narrowly averting a financial crisis, the Obama administration once again...
Journalism teacher Scott Mencher knows that nowadays... everyone is bombarded with information.
And that's why I teach a mass media class or news literacy class that just basically focuses on that. It gives them a chance to kind of digest. They get a lot of information, they get it from everywhere, but it's very overwhelming at the same time for them.
Not only is there a lot of information, but where is it coming from?
The idea of you know, just not just getting their news, but understanding the credibility and the validity of where they're getting it is very important because, you know, their main focus, their main news source is Facebook. And I also think that it gives them an opportunity to say, hey, you know what, not all information is equal.
So what are the students thinking?
Well, who do I trust, really? It have to be the true news channels.
Student John Cruz Jr. said he trusts the major news networks, such as CNN, because they live and breathe news.
You know, those kinds of gritty, pure news channels. They talk about news all day.
For aspiring photojournalist Christian Rivera.
Seeing is believing, you know, and like what better way to see than through photography or through video.
Obviously, he's a little biased towards photography, but he understands the need for accuracy in photographs during this age of digital editing.
I personally, like if I'm doing like post-production on a photo, I learned photography in a darkroom. So now that I do digital, I kind of go by like if I wouldn't be able to do it in a darkroom, then I won't do it like in Lightroom or on Photoshop, you know?
Mencher, their teacher, says the students don't just want to know who to trust. They want to be trusted themselves.
They think their work is valuable and it's important, and they treat that trust aspect very important. And if they're able to do that here, hopefully you know, they'll have pride in their work in other places, and especially in the future, if they decide to major in journalism or have a career in journalism, they'll understand that, yes, trust is very important.
For Latino USA, I'm Daisy Rosario.
Planeta, a Terra, cidade,
São Paulo.
Como todas as metrópoles,
São Paulo.
Se achar hoje em desvantagem na sua luta contra o maior inimigo do homem, a poluição, e apesar dos esforços das autoridades de todo o mundo, pode acontecer um dia que a Terra, o ar e as águas.
Well, it can be hard not to feel overextended. With work, family, so many of us try and juggle everything, and we end up feeling all the more lost for it. I know I feel it all the time. So for this week's Sabiduría, a few words of wisdom from Marta Moreno Vega, who shares another one of her favorite sayings with us. This one about spreading yourself too thin.
El perro tiene cuatro patas, pero solo un camino. I love that saying. When I first initiated into the Yoruba religion, when divination was being done, that was one of the first sayings that came out in divination. And what that was telling me was that I was all over the place, right? I thought I could, you know, do 1,000 multitasking things and do them right. And what that saying is basically telling you is that even though a dog has four legs, he can only take one path. And I had to focus and decide how I was going to organize all the things in my life so that they would happen, but that they would happen fluidly, not scattered like, you know, leaves in the wind. So that's one of my dear sayings. You know, el perro tiene cuatro patas, pero solo un camino.
And that's it for this week on Latino USA. Mis queridos, please keep working, keep living, and of course, keep tuning in to Latino USA, because next week, we've got a few adventures for you on our Thanksgiving show. Don't miss it. Latino USA is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Jonathan Wolf and Eva DeLapp. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. And special thanks this week to Pat Burns at Still in Motion Studios, where we recorded this week's show in San Jose, California. Additional engineering this week by Brendan Baker. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on Instagram. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Robots?
Robots. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.